shabbily dressed old man looks over his shoulder as he crosses an intersection. As he hurries along the sidewalk, he continues glancing over his shoulder. When the coast is clear, he takes a gift-wrapped box out from under his trench coat. Removing a bottle, he drops the box into an abandoned grocery cart and scurries off. In a doorway, he unscrews the cap from the liquor bottle. Before he can drink, he notices a police patrol car driving around the corner. Hiding the bottle under his coat, he steps out of the doorway and saunters casually along the sidewalk. The cops look him over as they drive by, but continue on.
Hi, Ed.
Hello, Ed.
What's your hurry, young fella?
Hi, Cecil. I'm just getting out of the cold. What's up?
Oh, no thanks. Not for me. You know I'm on the wagon.
Okay, Cecil. But you keep it out of your hat. I don't want to share it with them bums at the hotel.
Sure, Ed. I don't blame you.
Leaving Cecil on the sidewalk, Ed steps between two parked cars and hurries back across the street. On the other side, he ducks down an alley. From the alley, he turns into the yard behind a warehouse. Sitting down behind a stack of wooden pallets, he unscrews the cap on his bottle and drinks thirstily. Relieved, he smiles. But the smile fades quickly. Wincing with pain, Ed lurches to his feet. He trips over some poles and falls to the ground. Gripping his stomach, he struggles to his feet and staggers on. He leans against a wall for support. Then, he stumbles into a couple on the sidewalk.
Come on, get lost.
Pushed away, Ed falls down again.
What's the matter with him?
He's drunk.
The couple walks on, leaving Ed lying on the ground. He reaches out to them for help, then collapses. Burt Reynolds in Double Jeopardy. Also starring Norman Fell, Richard Anderson, Ned Romero, Ina Hartman. Guest stars Susan Oliver, Jerry Ayers, Gerald S. O'Loughlin, Chris Robinson, Jan Michael Vincent. Special guest star Fritz Weaver. Executive producer Quinn Martin. Producer Anthony Spinner. Director of photography Ben Coleman. Written by Robert C. Dennis. Directed by Virgil W. Vogel and Ralph Sineski. Ambulance attendants lift a stretcher out onto the ground. Then they wheel it up the ramp to the emergency room.
Name's Ed Gurney. Age 43, no known address. We've had him before.
For what?
Bad booze, malnutrition. We pump him out, give him a mealtime loose, all we can do.
What happened this time?
What he was drinking this time wasn't just bad, it was poison. Escadine would be my guess.
Escadine? Where would he get that?
And a bottle of scotch. Royal Inverness, he said.
Nobody would go to all that trouble just to murder a poor old rummy.
What happened to the bottle, Doc?
You never got around to saying. But you better find it in a hurry, or we'll have a run of dead winos.
The two detectives leave the room. Behind the warehouse, Cecil picks up Ed's bottle from the ground.
Ed!
He looks around for his friend.
Ed!
As Cecil walks away, he tucks Ed's bottle under his jacket.
Joe, I want a search party at the 300 block of Pacific Street. Need a dozen men within a half an hour.
A half hour. A dozen men. Dan, where am I going to get them?
I don't care where you get them. Just get them. We got to find that bottle now.
At the crime scene...
You know him?
No, we didn't know him, but just a bum. Probably lives somewhere on Pacific Street.
He could have lived in a flop house anywhere.
There's no sign of a bottle, huh?
Nobody could have dumped it before we got the call. He was on Church Street when we first spotted him.
Was he alone?
Yes, sir. We spotted him in the hotel entrance. He took off when we slowed down.
Maybe he dumped the bottle when he saw you.
Now, we checked. Didn't find anything.
Church in what?
Church in Powell.
No, thank you.
Leaving the two patrolmen, Dan and his partner Charlie get into their car. Later, near Church and Powell,
Dan.
Charlie picks the gift box out of the cart.
Look at this. Royal Infinite Scotch.
Removing an envelope from the box, Dan reads the card inside.
Happy birthday from Donald Esseltine. Esseltine.
It can only be one in Santa Luis. He's been playing piano at Eddie's bar for years.
Let's go.
At Eddie's, a man sits at the bar, nodding in time to the music. A waiter points him out to Dan and Charlie.
A break, Esseltine? I'll talk to you.
Some break. Later, pal, huh? I'm listening. Now, please.
Over there.
Picking up his drink, Esseltine leads them across the room to a booth.
Hey, what? What do you want to see me for?
Because you're the only Donald Esseltine of Santa Luisa. Now, did you fill us out?
Charlie shows him the car.
Oh, now, wait a minute. You guys may not like my sense of humor. You can't bust me for that.
Some sense of humor, sending a bottle of poisoned whiskey to somebody.
What? A bottle of poison whiskey. You're crazy. Nuts. Your name is on the card. So what? I never sent that package to anybody. My package came from Mickleberry's department store. The papers from Mickleberry's. But that isn't my package. What isn't? Mickleberry's has a record of what I sent.
We'll check on that. Now, who'd you send the gift to?
Dr. Michael Serling. The surgeon? Yeah.
What'd you send him?
A carving knife. What else would you send to a butcher? That's right, Jack.
Lifting the hook on his arm, Esseltine digs it into the table.
He claimed he had to cut my hand off. But I never will know, will I?
Back in their car.
You got a right to be bitter. Not too many jobs for one-handed piano players.
Tell you one thing, Dr. Serling's no butcher. He's a magician. I wrecked my knee in the Cal State game when I was in college. He put it back together. He's quite a man. This is car 9. Katie around?
Hello, Dan. This is Katie speaking.
Hey, Katie, is any word on that bottle yet?
Not yet.
Tell Joe to cover the Skid Row area. Anybody with a bottle, check them out.
That night, over on Skid Row, Cecil enters the Savoy Hotel. He steps up to the front desk.
Hey, Harry boy, look at this. Royal Inverness.
Cecil, I thought you were off the stuff.
I am. Almost 3 weeks now. This is it. You must have lost it. Is he upstairs?
Haven't seen him come in yet.
I'll just wait for him in my room.
Better leave the bottle here.
Don't you worry about me. I ain't falling off the wagon this time. No, sir. No, sirree.
Bottle in hand, Cecil heads upstairs. Harry shakes his head. Meanwhile, at a swanky party across town, people stand chatting to each other with cocktails in their hands.
Leona, it's quite a birthday gift you give her.
It's a turntable and a stereo receiver.
It's a shame he's not here.
Said it was an emergency. I suppose it can't be helped.
Leona excuses herself to answer the door.
Mrs. Erling? I'm Lieutenant August. This is Sergeant Willits. Is your husband at home?
No, I'm sorry. Is anything wrong?
You tell us where he is?
He said at the hospital, an emergency appendectomy.
Thank you.
Officer, can't you tell me what's wrong? Is Michael all right?
Yes, he's all right.
Then someone else is in trouble?
Yes. Good night.
She turns away from the door, concerned. Meanwhile, at the hospital, an operation is underway. In the gallery outside the operating room, a young doctor observes the procedure through the window. The gallery door opens, and Dan and Charlie join the young doctor at the window.
Any idea what time Dr. Searle is going to finish? 2.5 minutes.
2.5?
He's closing now. The great man has a flat rate. He never works overtime.
What if there are complications?
Dr. Searle doesn't allow complications. Who are you guys?
Police Department. I'm Lieutenant August. This is Sergeant Willits.
Dr. Riddell.
Doctor.
Sergeant? You guys wouldn't be gonna bust him, would you?
Hardly.
It's too bad.
As the doctor leaves, Dan shoots Charlie a quizzical look. After the surgery...
Long time, Doctor. What do you remember?
Oh, 1959. Compound fracture of the left knee, wasn't it?
How is it? Doctor, did you get a bottle of Royal Inverness from a Donald Heseltine for your birthday?
I think there was a bottle. I don't know who sent it. I haven't had a chance to open any of my office presents yet.
Can we see them?
Well, what is this all about? I don't understand.
Can we see them?
Yeah, right in my office here.
Wrapped presents crowd the desktop.
Well, the bottle was here earlier. Somebody's walked off with it, I suppose.
There's nothing there with Mickleberry's paper, Dan. There's no bottle, no knife, nothing.
Check with Mickleberry's in the morning, find out what Esseltine bought.
Dan, what's this all about?
You know a man named Ed Gurney?
Yeah. He's a patient, a long time ago. He's been down on his luck for years. Sometimes I pay his rent, sometimes he comes around for handout. Well, now I understand. You think Ed stole the bottle? Oh, come on, don't tell me. A lieutenant of homicide comes around to invest...
Doctor, that bottle of whiskey was full of escadine.
Escadine? That's a deadly poison. Ed Gurney drank some and died.
Ed is dead? We believe that bottle of whiskey was meant for you, to kill you.
To kill me? That's nonsense. That's ridiculous. Donald Esseltine? That's impossible.
Nothing's impossible.
But I mean, nobody would want to kill me.
Nobody.
Searling shakes his head, then averts his eyes.
Doctor. Lieutenant, I have no enemies. No, there's been some terrible mistake.
There may have been a mistake, Doctor, but there's no mistake about that bottle of whiskey. It's full of escadine, enough to kill 100 people. Have you got any idea where Gurney lived?
Yeah, the Savoy Hotel. Why?
Maybe that bottle's still there.
Over at the Savoy, Cecil sits reading a newspaper. His eyes drift over to Ed's bottle. Dan and Charlie walk into the lobby of the hotel.
Hey,
Ed Gurney, what room is he in?
He's not in.
Just give us the key.
I'm not supposed to do that.
Just give us the key.
Cecil appears on the landing above them, then tumbles head over heels down the stairs to the lobby. Dan raises Cecil's head from the floor.
I'm sick.
Don't try to move. Don't move.
The bottle. Where's the bottle?
The bottle. Where's the bottle?
Cecil is dead. Upstairs, Dan and Charlie search Ed's room. Empty-handed, they walk out into the hall. As the janitor raises the bottle to his lips, Dan rips it from his hands.
Hey, what is this?
That's it.
You're a lucky man.
Later.
Here. Take a look at this cap.
The lab technician hands it to Dan.
What do you find?
I don't find anything.
Look inside.
Small hole, right?
Here's what you do. You very carefully loosen the excise stamp, peel it back, take a hypodermic needle, insert it through the cap, thus. Now you've got scotch and escadine. A heated blade will smooth the plastic and hide the point of entry. You stick the stamp back down and send it to your worst enemy. Unless he looks inside the cap, he never suspects a thing.
Pretty clever.
The Borgias never did better.
No prints.
Well, the only prints were made by Gurney and Cahill and that janitor. They weren't the real target, were they?
No, they weren't, Spence. It's meant for a doctor.
How tough is it to get escadine? Well, put it this way, it wouldn't be an overwhelming problem if you work in a hospital.
At Serling's office.
What a doctor, why not a nurse? What are they, nuns? Are they priests? They're human. They hate, they kill just like anybody else.
Like patients?
Yes, like patients. Like Donald Esselstyn. But it's possible. He had a motive. After all, I had to remove his hand. He accused me of rushing it or of making a mistake. Is that why you brought him up? You have some...
He claims he sent you a gift from Nickelberry's. A butcher knife. Now we're checking with Nickelberry's. If what he claims is the truth, Doctor, he'll be in the clear.
What he claims is true, then I'm afraid you've got yourself quite a problem. I'm not a popular man. I've been led to believe there won't be too many mourners at my funeral. I don't understand. You don't understand what?
Yesterday you told me you didn't have an enemy in the world.
Call it shock. A man likes to think somebody hates him enough to want to kill him.
What are you talking about? There isn't anyone in this town that doesn't respect you. Doctor, when are you going to start leveling with me? How am I supposed to help you if you don't?
Lieutenant, I've become a successful man. I've become a demanding man. Nobody likes to have demands made on them. People resent success.
Well, then you're going to need protection, because you'll try it again.
I don't want protection. I don't want a lot of policemen following me around. I assure you I can take perfectly good care of myself. Doctor... Now, Lieutenant, if you'll forgive me, I have to prepare for a meeting of the disciplinary board. Good day.
What's happened to you in the last 24 hours? Why is it all of a sudden you don't care about living?
Good day, Lieutenant.
Dan walks out.
Dan?
He turns to Joe, who approaches with a nurse.
This is Miss Craddock, one of the nurses here.
Hello?
Miss Craddock. Would you tell Lieutenant August what you told me, please?
Well, yesterday I was working on this floor, and I saw Dr. Rodell go into Dr. Serling's office. I figured there had to be fireworks, so I ducked out.
Why fireworks?
Those two didn't get along. Everybody in the hospital knew they were heading for a showdown.
Dr. Rodell is a resident here.
Yeah, I know. I met him last night.
What's the trouble?
I'd rather not get into the middle of anything. You better ask the hospital director.
In the director's office...
Word couldn't have leaked out already. I haven't even had time to prepare a formal statement.
Well, you can be informal with me. What will the statement say?
that the hospital board will vote to terminate Dr. Rodell's contract here.
You tell me why?
When we brought him here, we thought Dr. Rodell was a very promising young surgeon. Unfortunately, he hasn't worked out as well as we'd hoped. He's been difficult. And last month, he prescribed medication for a patient contrary to the instructions of the doctor in charge.
You mean Dr. Serling?
Yes.
Is Dr. Serling responsible for Dr. Rodell being fired?
Most young doctors would have admitted their mistake and accepted the reprimand silently. Rodell's attitude was aggressive, belligerent. I considered it bordering on the psychotic. When I suggested psychiatric counseling, he just laughed at me.
Elsewhere, a woman falls to the bed.
I told you, just to stay off my back. He ruined my career. He's going to pay for it.
Don't be a fool. Don't make it any worse than it already is.
Rodell pauses in the doorway to look back at her. Then he hurries into the living room. Picking up his jacket, he goes out the front door. In the garage downstairs, Rodell opens his car door, then hesitates, concerned. Upstairs, the woman examines her cheek in a mirror. She rushes out of the bedroom to the front door. It's Dan and Charlie.
Hello. We're from the police department. I'm Lieutenant August. This is Sergeant Willems. Mind if we come in a minute? Is Dr. Rodell here?
No, he just left. What do you want?
Are you Mrs. Rodell?
No, I'm not. I'm his fiancée. Sharon Cooper.
Where'd he go? Where did he go, Miss Cooper?
I don't know. I mean, what do you want with him?
Tell us about this package from Mickleberry's.
He holds it out.
I've never seen it before.
It's already been opened. Just show us what's inside.
Look for yourself.
I'd rather you did it.
It's just a knife.
Essadine's gift. Rodell must have taken it out of the office.
Switch tags.
We'll have to take this along as evidence.
Evidence? Evidence for what?
Well, where did he go? Mm-hmm. A man's life may be in danger. Now, where did he go?
He went looking for Serling.
I'll call Serling at the hospital in the morning.
Meanwhile, at the Serlings... Leona goes to answer the door.
All right, where is he?
Rodell pushes past her into the house.
Where is he? Serling! Come on out, you dirty yellow! Serling!
Who are you? What do you want?
Where's your husband? Don't lie to me, because I know he left the hospital at lunchtime for his afternoon off.
You're Dr. Rodell. Aren't you the man my husband had fired? You're in no condition to talk to anyone.
I'm in no condition to waste time. Now, you're going to tell me where your husband is.
Dan and Charlie sprint out of Rodell's apartment complex. Later,
are you all right?
Leona nods at Dan.
He didn't hurt you, did he?
No. Yeah. There was a time when I thought he might, but I managed to calm him down.
Why didn't you call us the minute he left?
Oh, I didn't really think there was any danger. I mean, if I had, I certainly wouldn't have told him where my husband was.
You told him?
I thought maybe if they sat down together, they could work it out.
Where did you tell him your husband was?
He spends every Thursday afternoon on this boat. It's called the Rosalind II.
The Rosalind II is moored at the marina. On the boat, Rodell spots Dan and Charlie's car as it pulls into the parking lot. Running across the grass bordering the parking lot, Dan and Charlie spot the Rosalind II. Rodell makes a break for it, trying to escape along the wharf. Dan races along the ramp overlooking the marina, hops over the railing, and jumps down onto the wharf, heading Rodell off. Rodell reverses direction, slides to a halt as he sees Charlie coming, and darts up a gangway. Dan leaps from the wharf to the boat. Fending Charlie off with a kick, Rodell boards the boat. Dan chases him to the stern. As Rodell tries to climb over the railing, Dan leaps, carrying them both into the water. Rodell tries to swim away, but Dan catches him. Dan's punch sends Rodell reeling. Dan grabs him and tows him to safety at the side of the wharf.
What about Serling?
Rodell chopped up the bottom. The hold's full of water. Serling's down there. We're too late.
Later, at headquarters...
Come on, Rodell. What'd you do with the body?
If I killed him, do you think I'd tell you?
Well, from what we hear about you, you're the type who might boast about it.
Yeah, I'm psychotic.
I'd say that's a pretty good diagnosis. Somebody that goes around chopping holes in the boat, that's a little nuts, isn't it?
All right, I hate him. I had every right to. He ruined my career. But I don't know where he is. I didn't kill him.
Now let me get the story straight. You're upset because the poison didn't work. A little impatient. Went down to the boat.
Poison? What are you talking about, poison?
We got a witness who saw you sneak into Serling's office. Substitute a bottle of poison whiskey for one of the birthday presents.
Oh, yeah. Now who's psychotic, huh? It's you. You don't even make sense. What poison whiskey? Huh? What presents?
Dan brings out the carving knife.
That present.
All right, I did take this home. But I don't know anything about any poison whiskey.
Odell, two old winos drank that whiskey and now they're dead. That makes murder, doesn't it?
I didn't kill anybody!
Leaning back against the wall, Dan stares at Rodell.
All right, I did go into Serling's office. I didn't think anybody saw me. I thought it didn't make any difference.
Why? Why'd you go in the office?
I was looking for something. See, there's a rumor around the hospital that Serling has a mistress. And I thought that if I could find proof, I could get him to withdraw charges against me.
You didn't find anything, did you?
Yeah, I found something. Check stubs. He's been paying rent on this apartment to Mountview for 4 months now.
Where are these stubs now?
My apartment.
This was in your apartment, too.
Well, I can explain that. You see, when I went into Serling's office, somebody else came in there.
You mean somebody else came in and switched the packages?
Yeah.
Who? Now, if you're telling the truth, somebody else is going to take the rap for the death of two winos. Now, don't be cute.
You're not going to believe this. It's a living truth. The person I saw switch those packages was Dr. Michael Serling.
You're right. We don't believe it.
It's the truth.
Dr. Serling planted a bottle of poison whiskey on himself?
Who said he was going to drink it? He's got a wife and a mistress, hasn't he? It's one woman too many.
It's really a terrific story, Rodell.
But it still doesn't explain this knife in your apartment.
When Serling left his office, I saw him throw this in the trash bin. I took it home just to see what he was throwing away.
Book him.
Later, outside headquarters, a man meets Dan and Charlie.
George, what'd you drag us down here for? Couldn't it wait?
No, it couldn't wait. Morning report says you found the check stub in Rodell's apartment, and they back up his story.
That's right, so?
So, why don't you arrest Dr. Serling for murder?
Because we don't buy Rodell's story.
Those check stubs don't prove a thing, Chief. Rodell could have gotten them any place, any time.
For all we know, George, Dr. Michael Serling could be lying dead somewhere right now.
Car 11 to car 9, come in.
August.
Dan, still no sign of Serling. But the check stubs to the Mountain View paid for an apartment for a girl named Linda Perry. She moved in 4 months ago, right after her stay in the hospital.
The hospital?
That's right. She was brought in because she tried to commit suicide by cutting her wrists. That was a week before the apartment was taken for her. The doctor that sewed her up was Serling.
Meanwhile, at Linda Perry's apartment...
I know I called 20 minutes ago, operator, but this is urgent. I've got to get through to Zurich. But if the circuits are busy, can you go through Rome? Yes, I will pay the difference, operator. Yes, I'll wait.
Would you like another drink, Michael?
Oh, thanks, Linda. It doesn't seem to be helping very much.
How about some coffee?
No, thanks, nothing. Hans, is that you? It's Michael. I've been trying to reach you all afternoon. Hans, listen, I made the arrangements. The plane
pregnant,
arrived.
Linda examines her swollen belly in
tomorrow.
The dresser mirror.
Be there.
Serling waves her to the door. Closing the bedroom door, she walks across the living room.
Miss Linda Perry?
Yes.
I'm from the police department. I'm Lieutenant August. Can I talk to you a minute?
I'm sorry. I can't talk now. I'm not feeling very well, and I was about to rest.
This won't take long. You're a friend of Dr. Michael Serling's, aren't you?
Why?
Well, we're afraid something might have happened to him.
Oh, no. He's perfectly all right, I can assure you. I just spoke to him a few minutes ago. He's on his way home.
Dan notices the phone cord running across the carpet and under the bedroom door.
You mind if I use your phone a minute?
There's a phone downstairs. I told you, I'm not feeling well.
That's right.
Now, wait a minute.
Dan pushes past her.
Don't go in there. You have no right to do this.
If Dr. Serling's in that bedroom, I do.
Dan!
Serling comes out of the bedroom.
May I ask what you're doing here?
I was just about to ask you the same thing, Doctor.
Miss Perry's a patient. I'm a friend. And I assure you, Lieutenant, she can't help you find the man who's trying to murder me.
I'm not so sure anybody is trying to murder you now, Doctor. Just how long have you and Miss Perry had this, relationship?
This what?
What are you trying to say?
4 months ago, Miss Perry tried to kill herself. Now, you don't suppose that the reason she did that was because the man that was responsible for making her pregnant is married, do you?
Dan, I swear to you that's not true.
Why don't you tell me what is true? When are you going to stop holding out on me? When are you going to stop lying?
I suggest you tell me plainly just exactly what you mean.
What's your favorite drink, Doctor? Royal Inverness Scotch, isn't it? Or is that your wife's?
Are you suggesting that I would want to do away with my wife?
That's exactly what I'm suggesting.
Oh, my God.
I hope you have proof.
I have an eyewitness that saw you take a poison bottle of scotch into your office and switch tags with Esseltine's present.
That's not true.
You're going to take that scotch home, Leona, take a drink of it, and we'd arrest him for murder.
You'll never prove that.
I'll try, Doctor. I'll try.
Come on.
Dan ushers Serling out of the apartment. Linda looks troubled. Later, at headquarters...
Arresting a man like Serling on such evidence, if I can dignify it by calling it evidence, is grabbing at straws.
Take it easy now, Dan. Why don't you look at it from our viewpoint? Man's got a motive, he's got a wife, and he's got a mistress. The girl's a patient until proven otherwise, and she tried to commit suicide because she was pregnant. Now, his wife won't give him a divorce. And even if she did give him a divorce, it would wreck him professionally.
Speculation.
Ben, those two dead winos, that's not speculation.
The only testimony against Serling is tainted by prejudice. Well, no district attorney in his right mind would even put Rodell on the stand. That's why I insisted that he be released. I'm sorry, but I had no other alternative under the law.
You bear this in mind. One thing hasn't changed. He still has a wife, and he still wants to get rid of her.
Even if you're right, Dan, I doubt if he'll try it again now.
The man is psychotic enough to try to murder his wife once. He'll try to murder her again. Maybe not in the same way, Ben, but he'll try to murder her again.
Dan looks out the window of the chief's office to see Serling walking out, a free man.
Next time, how do you suggest I stop him?
Later, Joe gets out of his car and walks to the front door of the Serling's home. A nurse answers the door.
Yes?
Good morning. I'm Sergeant Ruth Uren. I'd like to see Mrs. Serling, please.
She's not here.
Just a second. When will she be back?
I don't know. I'm sorry, I just don't have that information. You'll have to see Dr. Serling about it, and he's at the hospital.
Why does she need a nurse? Is she sick?
I'm not at liberty to give out any information. You'll have to talk to Dr. Serling.
The nurse closes the door in Joe's face. Joe walks back to his car.
Car 9, come in, Dan.
Yeah, Joe.
Dan, something's up. I think we may have been too late to warn him.
At the hospital.
I'm sorry. Can't perform the Watson operation. I have to get somebody else to do it.
I don't understand you. That operation is scheduled 30 minutes from now.
You'll have to get somebody else to do it.
My help. I'm entitled to an explanation. What's the matter with you? This morning you were too tied up on the phone to make your round. You've been tense.
Then I'm doing the patient a favor by not operating. Just you stop wasting time and call my standby, Dr. Holbrook.
When Serling leaves the administrator's office, Dan catches up with him.
Good morning, Doctor. I've been looking for you.
Really, what now? Sent one of my men over to get some information from your wife. All they got was a lot of double talk from the nurse.
My wife's nerves have been bad for some time. I hired a companion for her. She did just what she's being paid to do.
Where is your wife, Doctor?
At home.
The nurse says she isn't.
When Mrs. Haskins said that, it was to protect my wife. Now, if you'll forgive me, August, I'm scheduled for surgery.
Not you. Do I have permission to interview your wife?
You do not.
Then can I see her if I don't talk to her?
Are you afraid she's already dead, Lieutenant?
Can I see her?
You may not see her.
Then I'll get a warrant and search your house.
Dan walks away. Back at headquarters.
Dan, you said yourself that he wouldn't try it again so soon. So what's so urgent? Unless he was totally insane.
I wouldn't rule that out, George. There's been a lot of changes in the man.
Based on the evidence, I don't think you can get a judge to sign a search warrant.
That's why I want you to do it.
Well, I'll try Judge Medius. What'll I say you're searching for?
A dead body.
Later, at the Serlings...
There's nobody here.
Yeah.
Leaving Charlie and the three officers at the front door, Dan walks along the side of the house and peers through a window. He sees the nurse inside talking on the phone. Rapping on the window, he points her to the front door.
Mr.
I'm sorry. I was on the telephone.
We're from the police department. We have a search warrant. We're checking for evidence of homicide.
Homicide? Search? I don't know about any of this. I'm going to have to speak to
you. No phone calls, Mr. Fenton.
Guys, check the back.
Charlie and one of the officers follow Dan inside.
Take the upstairs, Charlie.
Walking into the master bedroom, Dan checks the closet. Then he moves along the hall. Downstairs, Charlie sets a suitcase on a table beside another one.
What do you got?
Found these hidden in the back of a closet. Pretty heavy.
Open them at the same time.
What do you got?
Clothes. What have you got?
Clothes.
Dan looks at the phone.
Somebody's making a phone call. Where's the nurse?
In the kitchen making coffee.
Yes, sir. She just called. She's at the marina, the Fremont's boat.
Dan and Charlie enter the kitchen behind her.
Thank you. I'm glad I did the right thing. I wasn't sure.
She realizes she is not alone.
All right. I call the doctor. He's entitled to know that strangers are ransacking his home.
What did he tell you to do?
Nothing. Go ahead and search. You won't find anything.
Why? Did he get rid of the body?
What body? What are you talking about?
His wife. She's dead, isn't she?
No.
He killed her, he disposed of the body.
Are you insane? There's nothing wrong with Mrs. Serling. What, just a little while ago she phoned. You were at the front door.
Phone from where?
I don't know. She didn't say. She left early this morning, without warning.
Without her luggage?
Yes. That's what she phoned for. She asked me to take her clothes to her.
Take them where? Mrs. Haskins, we're investigating a murder here. Now take them where?
Marina. She's hiding on a friend's boat. Fremont's.
Hiding from what?
The doctor.
The doctor? The doctor hired you, didn't he?
Yes.
Well, then she knows if she calls that you'll call him. Well, why would she do that?
I don't know why, but she did. And that's the truth.
Just now on the phone, did you tell the doctor where she was?
Yes.
Let's go, Charlie.
That night, at the marina, Leona appears on the deck of the Fremont's boat. Stepping off the boat, she walks along the dock. She strides onto the main pier. Coins into a cigarette machine. She pushes a button. As she bends to collect her pack from the machine, a car pulls up to the pier and stops. Noticing the car, Leona ducks behind a stairway. Leona opens fire, and Dan ducks behind his car door. As Dan creeps off into the darkness, Leona fires at Charlie, who takes cover. Dan slips out from behind a boathouse and onto the pier. As Leona retreats along the pier, she runs right into Dan's arms. She struggles to escape, but Dan hangs on to her. Then he drags her out of the shadows into the light.
All right, Charlie.
Charlie turns as a Cadillac pulls up beside him.
Hugh, I thought it was my husband. He's trying to kill me. I swear I thought it was my husband.
Sure you did.
He's tried it before, too. I knew that I'd never be safe at the house anymore. So I came out here to hide. But he's followed me here. He wants me dead.
No, Mrs. Serling, he doesn't want you.
Serling approaches with Charlie.
Keep him away from me.
You're going to be all right, Mrs. Serling. You're going to be perfectly safe.
You don't believe me. There is another woman. He's carrying his child. Admit it, Michael. You're paying her rent for her. You love her.
Leona, Leona, I never loved her. She's a patient who needed a friend.
Oh, lies. He was going to leave me. And he wanted to marry her. Well, when I told him I'd never give him a divorce, he was going to have me put away.
Is that what you've been trying to do all this time? Protect her? I had no choice. That's why he decided not to cooperate with us.
Well, what else could I do? She's my wife. I couldn't let her be arrested. I couldn't let her be locked away in a mental institution. I made arrangements for her to enter a private sanitarium in Switzerland. She would have been treated by the finest psychiatrist I know, Dr. Hans Loder.
Don't listen to him. He's lying. He's a terrible person. He's always plotting against me. He tries to hide it, but I can see through him. So, you're going to have me locked up, were you, Michael? It's a wicked thing to lock anybody up. But it wasn't really necessary, Lieutenant. It isn't necessary at all.
Mrs. Serling, two men are dead because of you. Don't you understand that?
But that was all a mistake. I never meant for it to work out that way at all. You can't blame me for a mistake, can you?
Taking Leona by the wrist, Dan leads her away. Later...
And how upset you are about the Serling case. But I'm afraid you have a long night ahead. About 11:20, we received a call that a woman's body was found in a ditch. No, the caller hung up without giving his name. That's right. Charlie is checking the location now. Thanks, Dan.
Dan and Charlie meet a colleague at the crime scene.
Mike?
Dan? Charlie?
Mike. What do you got?
Female Caucasian, 20, 25 years old. Appeared to be a fracture of the occipital bone near the right ear. It's also a bruise on the left side of the jaw.
Which came first?
Well, I might want to change later, but right now I'd say she got hit in the jaw and struck the back of her head against something hard. Didn't have to be too hard either. She's got a very thin skull. Average woman would have survived it.
Anything else, Mike?
She was raped.
And murdered.
Ambulance attendants carry the woman's body away on a stretcher.
But you put up a pretty good fight, Dan. Skin under the fingernails. When you find the man, he'll be marked.
Lieutenant Huggins?
Hello, Henley.
I think I recognize you, sir.
Who is she?
Sherry Lazar, when I knew her. Later, she married a fellow named Stan Manders.
Later, at the Manders residence, a man stands.
Come in. Who are you guys?
Your name's Dan Manders?
Dan flashes his ID.
Can you turn that radio down?
I said, oh, that's wrong. The radio's too loud.
Charlie walks over to the radio.
Is your name Stan Manders?
Yeah.
Is your wife at home?
No.
Walking into the kitchen, Stan tosses his beer can into the sink, then gets a fresh one from the fridge.
You know where she is?
No. You don't seem very interested, Mr. Manders. Police come to your house at midnight, ask about your wife. You don't even want to know why.
She doesn't live here anymore. I haven't seen her for 2 months. Now, why should I care?
Can you tell us who she's staying with?
Staying with her old man the last I heard. If she's not there, I don't know where she is.
What's his name and phone number?
Dominic Lazar, 555-4720.
Charlie walks into the living room and picks up the phone.
Dominic Lazar? This is Sergeant Willens of the police. Can you tell me where your daughter went this evening?
Stan leans against the kitchen counter, sipping beer.
Well, I can't really discuss it over the phone. Could you meet us at police headquarters, say, in 45 minutes? Fine. Thank you.
What's all this about?
We have reason to believe that your wife is dead. Murdered.
Stunned, Stan looks down.
He said she had a date at the Roundup Cafe, and he doesn't know with who. I'll check in with
him. At police headquarters, Dan and Charlie escort Stan into the squad room.
Joe.
Hi, Dan.
Anything come in from the murder site?
Nothing so far. The attack took place somewhere else, and the body was dumped there. Did you get a positive identification?
Sherry Manders.
Dominic Lazar has arrived.
Stanley? What happened to Sherry?
She's dead. Well, how did she get that way, Stanley? Did you kill her?
Ridiculous, Dominic.
Hey, talk to me, Stanley.
All right.
I want to hear you say you didn't kill her.
Knock it
you
off.
You want to tell me the truth, I'll break your neck.
Dan and Charlie pull Dominic off Stan.
What?
Charlie ushers Stan away.
Come over here.
At the cooler, Dan hands Dominic a cup of water.
Just tell me one thing. Did he kill her?
She was raped, Mr. Lazar. Now why would her own husband attack her?
Because that's the way he is, like an animal. Even when they were married, he wouldn't take no for an answer. He'd beat her. That's why she came back home to live, because she couldn't take it. Maybe he'd done it again.
Does she have any other boyfriends?
No. No boyfriends. She never played around. Let me sit down.
Sure. Say, she didn't have any boyfriends. She had a date tonight, didn't she?
Well, it's the first time since she left Stanley. I don't know who it was. All she told me was, don't wait up. Pop, I'm going to the roundup. I told her, you're a grown woman. You've been married. Why should I wait up? I waited up.
Charlie leaves an office where Stan has been examined for scratches.
No scratches.
No scratches.
What's his story?
Well, he claims he went to every beer joint in town last night. Trouble is he doesn't remember which place at which time.
I turn him loose. But he stays on the list.
List? What list? Who else do you have?
Sherry's date tonight. That gives us two suspects.
Two victims. Maybe your date's lying out there someplace, too.
Later.
I used to give her a lift home the nights we stayed open. Tuesdays and Fridays. The night she didn't need a ride.
What up?
She had a date. Lieutenant. I want to know why she was murdered. Had she been criminally attacked? Ugly. What makes men do such things? If I'd only stepped in, I knew in my heart those boys were up to no good, but when she went along with them, willingly enough, or so it seemed, I persuaded myself it was all right.
What boys are you talking about?
Well, there were three. No, four.
Two of them held the door and tried to coax her in, and the other one stood by, and it was the driver. That makes four.
Is it possible that one of those boys was the man she had a date with tonight?
Troy Stedman? No, he was only 17, much too young for a woman like Sherry.
Troy Stedman?
So Sherry came to work for us. He's been our steadiest customer. Although all he ever read was paperbacks.
Mr. Prescott, could you positively identify Troy Stedman as one of the boys in the car?
No, it was dark. It was some distance away. My eyes aren't that keen.
Well, what about the car? You must have seen the car. What about the color of the license plate, something like that?
No, I'm afraid not. I only knew Sherry a month. And yet somehow I felt I've always known her. Since I'm a coward, Sherry's dead.
Mr. Prescott, there were four of them. You were badly outnumbered.
So was poor Sherry.
Dan makes a call from the car.
Joe, run a check on a 17-year-old kid named Troy Stedman. He doesn't have a record. I'll settle for an address.
Right away. Well, Dan, I checked out the Roundup Cafe.
Do you have any luck?
They had a recording artist as a guest star. The place was really crowded. I checked out everyone on the staff, and nobody remembered seeing her.
All right, thanks, Joe.
They visit the Stedman's large house.
Come on in here, gentlemen. Look, that party out there is for my anniversary. What's so important it couldn't wait until morning?
We'd like to talk to your son, Mrs. Stedman.
Troy? He's not here.
He's not home either.
I know that.
You know where he is?
I do. Now, I'd like to know what you're investigating, why you think Troy is involved.
A young woman was raped and murdered. Her son knew her.
He what?
He knew her. We have reason to believe that he was in a car that picked her up.
What are you trying to say, Lieutenant? Troy doesn't even have a car. He left by... What time was this woman murdered?
Somewhere around 11 p.m.
My son returned to Kearney Military Academy for the fall term. That's up near San Torino. To get there by check-in time, he had to take the 7:30 bus.
Did he make the bus?
I have no reason to doubt it.
Do you mind calling and finding out?
Not at all.
At the academy...
Yes, the boy's with me now, Mr. Stedman. The duty officer states that Cadet Stedman reported in tonight on schedule.
He's been there since 9 o'clock.
Would you care to speak to him yourself?
Yes, please.
It's your father, Stedman.
Dad? What is it? What's wrong?
Just a moment, son.
Stedman hands the phone to Dan.
This is Lieutenant August. She's been... Oh, my God. No, sir. No. Sir, I think I'm going to be sick.
Dismissed. Mr. Stedman. What? Oh, I see. Well, Lieutenant, would you mind telling me what this is all about?
Someone sneaks into the Academy's physical education office. Switching on the desk light, Troy picks up the phone. Back in Santa Luisa, a young man answers the call.
Hello. What? Oh, who's this? Oh, Troy. It's 2 a.m. You're lucky my folks aren't in. She's... Hey, man, are you putting me on?
Griff, my old man just called me. Cops were there. They found Sherry dead by the highway. She was murdered.
Hey, man, cool it, will you? Look, we left you off to We dropped her off at the roundup. Sure, she was okay then. Whatever happened, it happened after that. Yeah, sure, it's too bad. I had nothing to do with it. I swear, Troy, I had nothing to do with it. Yeah, I'll speak to you later.
Griff's chest is scratched.
No doubt whatsoever that Stedman was in this school from 9 o'clock last night until this moment.
Dan meets with Troy and the Commandant.
The victim was last seen at 8:30 p.m.
Sir, I caught the bus at 7:30. Arrived here at 9.
The bus driver doesn't remember seeing you on the bus.
Well, it was crowded. I guess that's why. Here's my ticket stub.
Are you satisfied, Lieutenant?
Not quite. Do you mind taking off your shirt, Mr. Stedman?
May I remind you, this is not Santa Luisa. This is not even the same county. You have no authority here. The point I'm making, Stedman, is that if you do this, you do this voluntarily.
Yes, sir.
Undoing his tie, Troy begins to unbutton his shirt. He shows Dan his unmarked chest.
Turn around, please.
Dan pulls out Troy's shirt tail and examines his back.
Thank you. You liked Sherry, didn't you?
Yes, sir. I bought some books from her and talked to her a while. But she was nice.
Did she have many friends?
I don't know who else knew her. Maybe somebody from out of town did it.
I don't think so. I mean, she got in the car voluntarily. She'd have to know the people in the car to do that, wouldn't she?
No, sir. I guess she knew them all right.
Did you know them? Did you know them, Stedman? I have a pencil and a paper, please. Thank you. Stedman, I want you to give me a list of all your close friends in Santa Luisa.
Sitting down at the Commandant's desk, Troy begins to write. Later, at headquarters...
All right, you've got 26 names here. Maybe the guilty four aren't on here.
That boy knows who they are, George. He's looking for a way to tell me, and I gave him one.
Yeah.
There's a call for Dan. A Mr. Dominique Lazar.
Dan and Charlie pull up outside a church. A priest leaves Dominic on the steps and goes back inside.
Mr. Lazar?
I just finished making the funeral arrangements for my daughter. I don't suppose you know who killed her yet, do you?
No, not yet. Is that why you call us?
I do. Four boys. They dragged her into their car and they drove her someplace. And afterwards they killed her so that nobody would know who did it. Well, I found out who one of them is.
Where'd you get your information, Mr. Lazar?
A clerk at the book corner, Harriet somebody, I forget what her last name is. She said she saw these boys drive off with Sherry. She said one of them is Troy Stedman.
Mr. Lazar, we know about the four boys.
Now you know who one of them is. Arrest us, Troy Stedman.
We know about Stedman. He's been cleared.
Cleared?
What is this?
Cleared. He was there. He helped to do this to Sherry.
Mr. Lazar, the boy has an alibi.
Alibi?
He was in school at the time the attack took place.
That's a lie. He's lying. What kind of cops are you? You can't see that. Well, I'll tell you. These are rich boys from rich families. They don't care about the law. That's what's wrong with this country. There's two kinds of law. One for them, one for us. I'll tell you something else. They're going to pay.
All right, Mr. Lazar.
These boys murdered my daughter. You're not going to do your job. I'll see to it that they pay. I'm going to find that convertible. They'll pay.
What convertible?
The one she told me about, the one they drove.
At the book corner.
You say they got into a convertible?
Yes. I only had a glimpse.
Excuse me, Lieutenant. Has there been any... Have you found out who did it?
We're making some progress, yes.
We'll have made progress when he's in the gas chamber.
He was crazy about her.
Does Sherry know it?
Good heavens, no. He doesn't think anybody knows. He sneaks around so. I happen to know he goes to nudie movies.
Later at headquarters.
Check Troy's list of names for cars.
Any convertibles?
Three. One white one. One been in a repair shop for a while.
What about the other one?
Strong possibility. Belongs to a family named Whitaker on Mariposa Drive.
We'll have the lab check it out. Any boys in the family?
One. Name is Griff. Short for Griffin.
That night at the Whitakers, Griff and his friends are having a pool party. Griff lies on a chaise, fully clothed, kissing one of the girls. The other kids climb out of the pool. Then they jump back in, splashing the necking couple.
Hey! 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 Shut, man! What is this?
You just nervous! Don't be such a drag! Come on in!
I can't. I told you, doctor's orders.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, look, I ought to be home in bed. Look, I got asthma.
Look, and if you can't come in, change the music.
Yeah. Sure.
As Griff walks by, one of the girls grabs him, but he slaps her hand away. One of the guys reaches out of the pool, but Griff jumps away. Picking up a handful of peanuts from the refreshment table, he throws them in the pool, then walks over to the stereo to change the record. Griff pitches forward, staggers across the pool deck, and tumbles into the water.
There's something wrong with it. Griff's bleeding!
Later, Dan and Charlie question the kids.
We were all in the water at this end of the pool. Brenda and Griff were here on the couch. Kim asked Griff if he'd changed the records on the stereo.
Show us exactly what he did.
Well, he walked around. He walked around about this far. Then he walked over to the stereo to about here. It was about here, wasn't it?
It was at the end of the table, Ron.
About to here. Then he just reeled around like a drunk. We just thought he was clowning.
A searchlight startles Ronnie.
Take it easy, son. Bear's lining up the angle. The stereo drowned out the sound of the gunfire. A bullet caught him and spun him around right into the pool. He was probably dead before he hit the water.
Any marks on the body?
Yeah, his chest was all scratched up, just like Doc said.
Find out where Dominic Lazar was tonight.
Okay.
Charlie.
Yeah.
Do the same for Stan Manders.
Huh? All right.
Joe steps up to Dan.
What's up there?
Property backs up to a low hill. Halfway up, you got a clean shot at anybody here on the patio.
Rifle, huh?
Had to be.
How do you know which one? How do you know?
Later, Charlie walks into a funeral parlor.
Which friend have you come to see?
I was told that Dominic Lazar was here.
Oh, yes.
Mrs. Manders in slumber room 4.
I'm not a mourner. Would you ask Mr. Lazar to step out, please? Police business.
Excuse me, Mr. Lazar. There's someone to see you.
Dominic steps out into the hall. Stan stands behind him.
What do you want here?
Sorry, Mr. Lazar. Can we go someplace?
Why?
I'd like to talk to you. You too.
No. Nobody leaves, Sherry. You want to say something, you say right here.
All right. Where were you earlier this evening? Say between 8 and 9 p.m.
Here, right here.
Anybody with you?
Only one person. You want to talk to her?
Manders, where were you?
I was at home asleep.
At 8 o'clock?
I slept for 4 hours and then I came back to relieve Dunlap.
She's never going to be alone now. Why do you ask all these questions?
A boy was shot dead tonight.
A boy? What boy? One of the ones that killed Sherry? Okay. So he got what he deserved.
Even if he was guilty, he deserved a fair trial.
When they turn him loose, I know what the judge would say. Just a young kid that made a little mistake. Send him home, don't give him any spending money for a month.
You're not sending this boy home, Mr. Lazar.
What do you want from me? Tears? I already spilled them all for my own kid.
I want an alibi.
Alibi? Don't give me alibi. Alibis are for rich people who can pay people to lie for them. I got no alibi, so maybe you better arrest me. Put me in a cell and tell everybody that Dominic Lazar is a murderer. But you're still going to have to prove it, you see. You're going to have to prove that.
That's right. I'm going to have to prove it.
Dominic brushes past Charlie on his way out.
I'm on until midnight.
I'll be in touch.
In the morning...
I didn't even know her. Just what I read in the papers, that's all, about her being found dead. Well, that's all I know about her.
If I may say so, Lieutenant, I think you have a very fragile connection here. My son was a friend of Griff Whittaker, who may or may not have been involved with this Manders woman.
Griff Whittaker borrowed his father's car that night.
And so?
So we can prove that that car was involved in the murder of Sherry Manders.
I wasn't with him. I was over at Kevin's house, Mom. We were talking about school starting. As far as I know, I've never seen her.
Well, then you have nothing to be afraid of, do you?
No.
Good. Now, will you give us your friend's full name and address, please?
Kevin Coulter. 426 Lawton Place.
Thanks. Thank you.
Dan and Joe get up to leave, and Ronnie's mother follows them to the door.
Lieutenant, I hope this will be the end of it.
So do I. If I were you, I'd have your son stay close to the house. Thank you.
Ronnie calls Kevin.
Not even dressed yet.
Listen, you jerk. The cops are on the way over to your house. Look, just get out of there and don't let anybody see, okay? Okay. Okay, soon as I can make it.
I know he was here less than an hour ago because I called him on the phone.
At the Coulters.
He must have left for school early. Wait.
6-1, the phone call was from a young man.
Yeah, let's cruise around the neighborhood, see if we can find out.
Right.
A few blocks away, Ronnie walks past a community center. Crossing a playground, he looks around for Kevin. Giving a merry-go-round a push, he climbs on for a 360-degree view of the playground entrances and exits. Meanwhile, Dan and Joe drive through the neighborhood looking for him. Ronnie steps off of the merry-go-round and walks across the sand to the swings. Sitting on a swing, he begins to pump it into motion. all the while keeping an eye out for his friend. Dan and Joe drive on. As Ronnie swings higher and higher, Kevin jogs toward the playground. The shot knocks Ronnie off the swing.
Rifle shot.
Panicking, Kevin runs away. Dan and Joe sprint across the playground. Kneeling over Ronnie, Joe leans down to put an ear to his chest.
Ronnie's dead too. Our killer does it all. Investigates. Convicts and executes.
Later, in the chief's office.
How many more before we put a stop to this? All right. We don't know the name of the fourth boy in the car. How does the killer know so much? We catch him, George.
What about the girl's father?
The girl's father would have used his hands instead of a gun.
All right, her husband then.
Sherry left him 2 or 3 months ago. Why would he want revenge?
Gentlemen, we have a killer loose in this town, and the way everybody's talking around here, we don't even have a suspect.
I got one. What about Prescott? We know he was hung up on it.
I got another one for you. Sherry Mander's date that night at the roundup.
All right, that'll be all.
Dan, we've got four suspects and two kids to protect. Make it happen. Find out the identity of Sherry Mander's date the night she was murdered. And I want to know the name of the fourth boy in the car.
You just want a miracle, right?
Right. Yes. Charlie, put a guard on that Kohler kid until I tell you nothing.
Dan, if the Kohlers accept protection for that kid, isn't that an admission that he was involved in Sherry's death?
At the Kohlers.
My son doesn't need police protection. I've taken charge of that myself.
We'll have a unit looking out for him anyway.
He'll be guarding an empty stable.
Where is he, Mr. Kohler?
I'm not going to tell you. You've done enough damage already. Just by showing up to question my son, you've told this maniac who his next victim should be.
This maniac doesn't need any help from us. He knows.
It won't do him any good. I'm putting Kevin out of reach.
Kohler gets into his car.
You mean you're getting him out of the country, is that right?
I'm doing what's necessary. And if it bends any laws, we've got a good defense. Santa Luisa police have proven themselves incompetent to protect people.
Kohler drives away, leaving Dan standing in his driveway, troubled.
This is car 9. Tell Charlie to put an APB out on Kevin Kohler. Check the planes going out of Los Angeles and San Francisco.
Later, at an airport, Kevin glances cautiously around as he walks toward the boarding gate. As he passes through the gate, the airline agent shows the passenger manifest to a detective. Filing across the tarmac, the passengers mount the gangway to the plane. Inside.
Lieutenant August, I'm Inspector Tompkins. San Francisco Police Department. That boy you're looking for just came through.
Dan leaves his seat. Dan confronts Kevin at the top of the gangway. Kevin turns to find Charlie at the bottom. Swinging his bag at Dan, Kevin leaps over the railing and rolls neatly as he hits the tarmac. As Dan follows, Kevin gets to his feet, but Dan knocks him over. Kevin rolls to his feet and keeps running, but Dan tackles him and takes him down again. Later, by Dan's car.
It was an accident, you know. I mean, you're getting hurt. It was no accident. Somebody hit her.
Yeah, it was Griff. He got mad and he hit her.
Why don't you just start at the beginning, huh?
She was on her way to the roundup to meet a date. And we gave her a lift there. I mean, we were just for kicks. We didn't mean anything. At least I didn't.
Maybe Griff had something in mind. I don't know. He didn't stop at the roundup. He just barreled on past.
Why don't you just give us a name, son?
Griff, Ronnie, and me.
What about the other one? We got two witnesses who saw Sherry get in the car with four boys.
Oh, yeah. When we picked her up at the book corner, Troy was with us. He was on his way back to boarding school, and Griff said we'd drive him there. It was faster than the bus.
Then it happened on the way back.
After we left Troy off, yes, sir. She was mad about being late for a date. Ronnie and I tried to kid her out of it. We were just fooling around. Maybe Ronnie got a little too grabby. Anyway, she slapped him, and that made Griff sore. He stopped the car and told me to drive, said he'd cool her out. And then she jumped out of the car and tried to run, and Griff drug her back, and she scratched him up pretty bad.
Is that when he hit her?
Kevin nods.
He knocked her down. She seemed kind of, you know, dazed. I was driving. I really didn't see what Griff and Ronnie were doing to her back there.
You know what happened back there. You know what happened back there, don't you? Get in the car.
Dan joins Kevin in the back seat.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
We got her back to town, and she was out cold, pretty scared. I wanted to call an ambulance, but Griff wouldn't let me. He said we'd dump her someplace, and we'd all swear we'd never seen her. And then it'd just be her word against the three of us.
Yeah. Except she didn't live to talk about it, did she?
No, sir.
Did you talk to Troy about it?
No. No. He called Griff when he found out. I guess he was real uptight.
Later, Charlie pulls up in front of the military academy, and Dan gets out of the car. Walking past the well-trimmed shrubbery, Troy spots Dan. Minutes later, Troy dials a payphone.
Hello, this is... We know. That's right. Look, the cops just got here from Santa Luisa. They must know something to be coming back so soon. Look, I can't hold out any longer. If they ask me, I'll have to tell them. And you better make a run for it. I'll hold out as long as I can.
Sir, I don't know what you want me to tell you.
I want you to start telling me the truth for a change.
I've never told you anything but the truth.
All you've done is left a few things out. A few things like who the guilty boys were.
They were my friends.
That's sir. Very noble, Stedman. You shut your mouth off to somebody. And that somebody killed two boys. Now, isn't that enough for you?
Well, I didn't know he was going to do anything.
What did you think he was going to do? Hand out medals?
Anyway, I had to tell him.
You had to tell who?
Stan Manders. I mean, he threatened to shoot me. And I hadn't done anything. They did it. They deserved to be punished for what they did. They had no right to do that. Did they? Did they?
Back at headquarters,
Katie speaking. Yeah. Jeff, on three.
Rivera? Yeah, Dad.
Arrest Stan Manders for murder. And Joe, be careful, he's armed.
Patrol car drives down the lane beside headquarters and pulls into the police parking lot. Farther along the lane, a man steps out from behind a building and walks toward police headquarters carrying a brown paper shopping bag. It's Stan. He glances over his shoulder. Then he mounts the stairs on the outside of a building across the lane from police headquarters. From the landing, he climbs a ladder leading to the roof. Stepping onto the roof, Stan looks around to see if he's being observed. Then he runs across the roof to the other end of the building. He glances around again to see if he's been spotted. From his vantage point, he has a clear view of the police parking lot. Stan removes a rifle from his shopping bag. Extending the folding stock, he settles down to wait. Meanwhile, Troy and Kevin ride with Charlie and Dan.
Car 9.
August.
Dan, we've checked everywhere. So far, we're unable to locate Manders.
We'll keep checking.
Dan turns out of the lane beside headquarters to park behind the building. Getting out of the car, he walks around to the passenger's side. As Dan opens the doors for Troy and Kevin, Stan fires. Dan and Troy hit the dirt and Kevin crawls out after them. Charlie, too, emerges to take cover behind the car.
Down the roof.
Never a cop around when you need one. Cover me.
As Charlie fires at Stan, Dan sprints to an adjacent building. Taking the stairs two at a time, he crosses over a workshop, then climbs a shed leading to the roof. Two uniformed officers run to join Charlie behind the car. As Stan trades shots with Charlie, Dan runs along the roof, then tackles the shooter from behind, knocking his rifle over the edge. Dan punches Stan into the TV antennas, but Stan recovers his balance. Then he blocks a punch and knocks Dan down. Stan dives onto Dan, and they roll across the roof. When Stan pushes Dan's head over the edge, Dan drags him over it, and they fall to the shed below. Dan knocks Stan down. Stan kicks Dan away, then leaps to the landing at the top of the stairs. Recovering his rifle, he opens fire on the cops again. Stan takes a bullet from their return fire and tumbles down the stairs. Charlie and an officer emerge from behind the car. They holster their weapons as they walk over to where Stan lies. Charlie kneels in the dirt beside him.
I lie still. You'll be all right.
I got two of them. I wanted to get the other one.
Manders. Why?
They killed my wife.
But she left you.
She was coming back. That night she was going to meet me at the roundup. She was coming home again. Dominic was right. Nobody was going to do anything. So it was up to me. She was...
Stan's eyes flicker close. As As Charlie stands up, Dan comes down the stairs. He looks down at Stan, but Charlie shakes his head. Dan walks over to Troy.
I'm sorry. I only told
him because... Never mind.
I just want to try to make you understand.
Never mind.
But I loved her.
I wouldn't lean too heavily on that if I were you.
But I did.
So did Manders.
One of the uniformed officers takes Troy and Kevin away. Later, at Stan's house, Dan watches Dominic pack up.
This is their stuff. I'm taking it back to my place. Those lousy kids. Everything would have been all right if they hadn't killed Stanley, too. I'm going to take care of his funeral. Because what he did for me, too.
Dominic. He was no hero. He took the law into his own hands and now he's dead. And for what? Kevin will be tried and convicted just like the others would have been. When are people like you going to learn?
She was my daughter.
I know. And you loved her. But you go on hating like this because of what was done to her. And even her memory is going to go sour.
Dan walks away. This described version of Double Jeopardy was created by AudioVision Canada. The narrative description was written by Bill Williams, narrated by J.J. Hunt, and produced by Valerie Hunter and Marco Sorin. For information on other described movies and audio cinema presentations available from AudioVision Canada, call toll-free 1-800-567-6755. Cast: Burt Reynolds as Dan August, Norman Fell as Charlie, Richard Anderson as the Chief, Ned Romero as Joe, Ina Hartman as Katie, Fritz Weaver as Dr. Serling, Susan Oliver as Leona, Jerry Ayers as Dr. Rodell, Gerald S. O'Loughlin as Dominic, Chris Robinson as Stan, Jan Michael Vincent as Kevin.